Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. This is the Life Coach Radio Network on Blog Talk Radio. I'm so excited about today's show. My guest is AIDS activist Steve Peters, who in 1984 was given 8 months to live. He has defied his original prognosis and 5 near-death experiences to live a full, passion, and purpose-filled life. I'm your host, Jan Jaffe. Welcome to In Depth. Prior to his diagnosis with AIDS, Reverend Peters served as the pastor of the Metropolitan Community Church, or MCC, of Hartford from 1979 to 1982, where he was a leading gay activist. Diagnosed with GRID, G-R-I-D, in 1982 and ARC, A-R-C, in 1983, he went on to develop full-blown AIDS, stage 4 lymphoma, and Kaposi sarcoma in April of 1984. He was given 8 months to live. In 1985, his cancers went into complete remission while on Suramin, the first antiviral drug trial. Unfortunately, Suramin nearly killed him, and sadly, it did kill a number of other people with AIDS. The trial was ended, but Peter's cancers remained in complete remission, and he fully recovered from the toxic side effects of Suramin in 1987. Reverend Peters served for the next 11 years as field director of AIDS ministry for the MCC denomination. He traveled the world teaching and preaching about hope, grief, and surviving AIDS. He also volunteered as a chaplain at an AIDS hospice in Los Angeles. As an AIDS activist, he served on the Los Angeles AIDS Task Force, as well as the boards of directors of AIDS Project Los Angeles and the AIDS National Interfaith Network. He was featured in Life, Time, and Omni magazines, as well as the Los Angeles Times. He regularly appeared on CNN, was interviewed by people as diverse as Tom Snyder and Tammy Faye Baker, and was profiled by Jane Pauley to mark the 10th anniversary of the first diagnosis of AIDS. Steve became sick again in 2007 and over the next 6 years battled a number of illnesses, including pancreatitis, which nearly killed him in 2012. However, he came back from death's door once again, having had 5 near-death experiences since 1985, and he has now been relatively healthy since 2014. Most recently, he has reversed his type 2 diabetes through diet and exercise. Steve received his Bachelor of Science in Speech from Northwestern University, his M. Divinity from McCormick Theological Seminary, and his MA in Clinical Psychology from Antioch University in Los Angeles. Steve is now retired and lives in Los Angeles, where he takes great delight in singing beautifully, by the way, with the Gay Men's Chorus of Los Angeles. I am so excited to have Steve Peters as my guest on today's show. Welcome, Steve.
Thank you, Jan. It's great to be here.
Oh, and it's so great to have you here. As I mentioned, I am just so delighted. The number here is 646-716-9397. We welcome your calls, questions, comments, and contribution to the discussion. We love your participation. The number again is 646-716-9397. You know, Steve, first of all, I just want to say what a treat it is to have you here on the show today as a guest. And I also want to mention, there's so much I want to get into, but I noticed that we already have a caller. So,
oh, my goodness.
So I think, if it's okay with you, Steve, I think we might first just check in with our caller. What do you think about that?
Sure, that's fine.
Okay. Caller, your number ends in 2857. I was wondering if you would like to join us now or wait a little bit further into the show?
Happy to join you now.
Hello. Hello, hello. I think I recognize this voice.
I'm calling in because there were two things in Peter's biography that kind of caught my attention. One is that you went to Phillips Andover in your younger years. And I lived on Lock Street. I lived in a house that used to belong to the headmaster in the early 20th century.
Huh.
And after he died, his daughter lived there, and I bought the house from his daughter. And so we were right off the Phillips campus. And
yes. Yes.
I don't know. You must know where Lock Street is. And,
oh, sure. Well, I grew up in Andover. My father was on the faculty at Phillips Academy.
Oh,
so
yeah.
I'm very familiar with Lock Street, sure.
Okay. One interesting story is the reason I bought the house, or one of the reasons, was that the previous owner had been head of the garden club in Andover, and she had the most fabulous wildflower garden in her backyard, which really was the reason I loved the house. The house had been run down and had to do extensive renovation, but the flower garden was magnificent.
Well,
and
how
many
lovely.
Years later, after I'd moved, I took my wife there to show her where I had lived, and there was no one home, unfortunately, but we looked over the fence in the backyard, and it was a swimming pool with a little bit of grass around it.
Oh, no.
We were devastated.
Yeah.
But the other thing I wanted to tell you, the other connection, is that my wife went to Northwestern, also in the theater school, as you did, and loved it, and so had a great experience. So that's the end of my connection.
Okay. Well, that's
is
great.
Is it all right if I identify you?
You may.
This is my cousin Michael, my dear cousin
okay.
Michael. So I'm very honored and thrilled to have him join us. So as always,
good.
It's just a delight to hear your voice, Michael, and you know to have you call in. Thank you so much.
Good. Keep it up, Jan. Bye bye.
thanks, Michael. You take care and love to you.
Bye bye.
Bye
bye.
Okay, well, that was fun, and what a lovely connection. You know, Steve, you have such an interesting and inspiring story, and I wonder if you would mind, you know, I already gave a rundown of your story, but I wonder if you would mind sharing, you know, some of it or talking about it with our listening audience.
Sure. Well, I think the most interesting part of it was that, you know, being diagnosed in 1982 with GRID, or gay-related immunodeficiency, it was a time when there was so much fear because we didn't even know how it was transmitted back then. And I was terrified, and everybody around me was terrified. And I got sicker and sicker and sicker, and was sick through 82, 83, and into 84, when I was diagnosed with the two kinds of terminal cancer and given 8 months to live. When I was diagnosed with that, the doctor said, there's nothing we have to offer. We can't, there are no medicines. And your mission, should you choose to accept it, is to stay alive long enough for us to find a way to manage it. And so I set about finding, you know, creating my own wellness program. I read books about people who had beaten cancers that they weren't supposed to survive, and I put together my wellness program from that. There was nothing written about AIDS back then. And so I did everything I could think of to create the conditions for healing in my body. And that included exercise and nutrition and vitamins and minerals and laughter therapy and music therapy. I would drive around the freeways of Los Angeles with, you know, music and playing in my car and just sing along with it and think, you know, if I could only hold this note as long as Judy Garland held it, I know I'll survive. it was just, I put everything I could into surviving. And when I did survive the 8 month prognosis, my doctor invited me to be the very first patient to go on the very first antiviral, as you mentioned, a drug called Suramin. And it put my lymphoma and Kaposi's sarcoma into complete remission. I'll never forget the first night I was in the hospital to receive the first dose of Suramin. There was a nurse watching me full time, and you know, we anticipated some really heavy side effects on that first night, and nothing happened. There were no side effects in the initial dose, and the nurse was so bored. I was so bored. I started singing old songs like "Things Look Swell, Things Look Great." You know, and finally the nurse wrote down in my chart, the only significant side effect with Suramin is singing like Ethel Merman.
Hilarious.
Yeah. Well, it proved to be extremely toxic. It blew out my adrenal glands. It paralyzed me on the left side of my body. I went blind, all of which reversed itself eventually when I got off the drug. But I took the drug longer than anybody else took it. I took it for a total of 36 weeks. And the drug was so toxic, it killed 20% of the people who took it. And almost everybody else died from the progression of AIDS within a year or two. I was very fortunate to survive, that the side effects, you know, subsided, and I got well. And so it was a remarkable time in my life. I mean, in the 80s, nobody survived AIDS, or at least that's what we thought. You know, a great fuss was made over me because I survived against the odds, and I actually got well. I think that's the most dramatic part of my story.
My goodness. I mean, it's true. I think most of us, at least who were around back in those days, do have friends, you know, we all lost friends. Anybody that had AIDS, especially early, nobody lived. It was a death sentence back then.
That's right.
It is amazing what you went through. And but, you know, I'm so delighted that you're still with us. I want to mention, too, I don't think it's been mentioned. I know Steve, I won't say how many years, but we were in college together, and we did a couple of shows together, and you played my father in a Gilbert and Sullivan operetta.
That's right.
And, oh, my God, it was such good times. We were very young, and Steve has an absolutely beautiful voice, and you were
so
talented.
Well, and
so
does Jan,
on
it should
stage.
Be known.
Oh, thank you. But, yeah, we go back a long way, and Steve was always very, very impressive. You know, one of the things, I guess, that, and, you know, I don't know if you want to mention this at all. When we've talked before, you talked about your challenge with coming out, and just even to coming out to yourself, accepting that you were gay. I mean, it's a very different time now. It's not easy. You know, I'm not saying that it's a piece of cake now, but it's a very different time now than it was, you know, when we were growing up. So
exactly.
I don't know if you want to talk about any of that.
Sure.
Just as a service to other people, but also it tells a little bit more just about you and your character. Yeah. So would you mind sharing some of that with the audience?
Of course. That'd be fine.
Thanks.
I knew that I was different, that I was attracted to boys rather than girls from as far back as I can remember. And I also knew somehow that I learned that I was to be deeply ashamed of that, and that I should keep that a deep, dark secret. And so I grew up, especially after I passed adolescence, I got into adolescence, I was terrified that anybody would ever find out I was gay. And so I talked to a psychiatrist about it, who told me that it was a phase and that I shouldn't mention anything to my parents or anybody else because I'd outgrow it, and I wouldn't want to embarrass myself before I outgrew it. And I talked to a pastor, the pastor of the church we went to, who said much the same thing, that he didn't know anything about it, but he knew that I shouldn't say anything because that would ruin my life. So I didn't talk about it, and I just tried to keep it hidden for years and years and years until I was 23. And when I was 23, I came bursting out of the closet because I should mention that I'm a recovering alcoholic, and I drank alcoholically through college and the first year after college, or 18 months after college. And I finally crawled into the rooms of the 12-step programs that, you know, we all know about now. And I got sober. And I knew that in order to stay sober, I had to get honest about who I was. And this was the 70s, and, you know, we were facing fights from Anita Bryant and John Briggs, and Harvey Milk was my hero, who was the, you know, leading gay activist and city council member in San Francisco, and it was a great time to be gay. We had so much fun, and there was such a sense of liberation and freedom that was born at Stonewall there in New York City in 69, and oh, my goodness, it was heady stuff, and I was so glad that I came out. And it served me well in future years because, you know, in the 80s when everybody all these gay men started dying, I realized that, let's put it this way. I remembered my favorite fairy tale. My favorite childhood story was Peter Pan. And in Peter Pan, you know, we learn from Peter that a fairy is born every time a baby laughs for the first time. That's where fairies come from. And when the child grows old enough to say, "I don't believe in fairies anymore," that fairy drops down dead. Well, in the 80s, all kinds of good fairies, including myself, started dying. And I realized that we really needed to start believing in fairies. We needed to believe in our own selves and believe that we deserve to live and believe in the magic of fairies and the possibilities of living fully alive, even with HIV and AIDS. My coming out was a very empowering experience, and that empowerment moved me into believing in myself enough to do the work of healing, and eventually to survive the unsurvivable.
Oh, that's wonderful! I love the way you expressed all of that. It just shows such strength and such acceptance of yourself and love, you know, of everything and everyone. It's, you know, it was real. You said burst out of the closet, but it reminds me of that time lapse photography when you know plants bloom and you see them opening up as flowers, and that's kind of what it reminds me of.
Oh,
yes,
nice.
You know, life beginning, you know. So you've said, you know, before that AIDS saved your life, and most people would think that that's a contradiction in terms. So would you mind expounding on that a bit?
Sure. Well, you know, before AIDS, I was, you know, I came bursting out of the closet, yes, and I was sober, and so all those good things were happening in my life. But I was kind of floundering, and I didn't, you know, I was a pastor, but I wasn't a great pastor. I was an okay pastor, a good enough pastor. And I was just sort of muddling my way through life, and I was very lonely and all of that. And I just, you know, I didn't know quite how to negotiate life. And AIDS became a great teacher to me and really taught me how to be fully alive, even in the face of death. I think my faith really helped me out a lot in those terms. I was invited to preach the Easter sermon 2 weeks after I was diagnosed as terminal in 84, And without getting into too much, you know, theology or anything like that, it was an incredibly valuable experience to look at what it meant to believe in the Easter story as someone facing death. And what it taught me was that my life wasn't quite yet over, that I could be fully alive, even in the face of death, in the face of AIDS. I could still laugh. I could still sing. I could still dance. I could still enjoy all my friends. I could still be fully alive. And it empowered me to do everything I could to create the conditions for my healing, as I said before.
Oh, wow. That's so beautiful. It's so inspiring. You know, I want to talk about your philosophy of life. In our conversations, you've spoken repeatedly about how much you love life. You spoke about how making choices was and is essential when dealing with life-threatening health conditions in order to live fully, as you've just mentioned, when you can't but you want to do everything. You've also stated that problems create a great challenge to get into action. I love that. A great challenge to get into action. And that taking action creates hope. I love that.
Exactly.
Taking action,
exactly.
And I want everybody to listen, taking action creates hope. You've also talked about your personal philosophy of life as be here now, and living in the present.
Yes.
You've told me how you've learned and always keep in mind that there are no guarantees for tomorrow and that we are all terminal. This reminds you and keeps present in your mind what a gift life is. You know, I hear gratitude present as a constant in your thought processes. And you've also mentioned that psychology and theology have been your recipe for the antidote to shame and guilt. You told me, and you've told everybody now, that AA was invaluable mental preparation and instrumental in constructing this philosophy that's not only served you well, but also allowed you to survive, thrive, and flourish. Do you think that AA would be a good therapy for AIDS patients or perhaps even anyone diagnosed with a life-altering condition?
Well, sure. I really think the 12 steps are an invaluable tool that are given to those of us who are recovering alcoholics or addicts or overeaters or, you know, there are just so many different 12-step programs now for different kinds of problems that life presents. And it's been my experience that people who were barely alive and actually dying, when they get into doing the 12 steps, they come to life. It's a wonderful recipe for finding the solutions. We often talk about in the rooms of AA, we talk about living in the solution rather than living in the problem. And the importance of prayer and meditation, the importance of being of service, the importance of cleaning house, cleaning house meaning dealing with your resentments and dealing with making amends to people that you have harmed, to people in institutions that you may have harmed. And all of that combines to bring you to a fullness of life, which I think that many of us who are in recovery now lacked when we weren't in recovery. And so I say, I think it could be valuable to almost anybody for in terms of helping people learn how to live. But unfortunately, a lot of people don't feel the motivation to do the steps until they come smack up against a huge life problem. And you need motivation to do the steps because, you know, it's not easy. It's simple, but it's not easy.
It's a lot of work.
Absolutely. And this thing about being here now, I didn't come up with that. I mean, that's Ram Dass, be here now. And it's a beautiful philosophy, and it's very consistent with the 12 steps, which teach us to be present in the present moment, to only take one day at a time. I can handle, for 12 hours, I can handle a problem that, there was no way I could handle it for a lifetime. But for 12 hours, I can handle it, or for 24 hours, I can handle it.
Mm-hmm.
And breaking it down to just being in the moment and facing things in the moment really helps keep things simpler. And sometimes those of us who, at least those of us who have addiction problems, need to keep things simple. The
mm-hmm.
other thing that you mentioned that I want to come back to is that, a lot of times people would like feel really sorry for me because I was dying, because
mm-hmm.
I didn't have any guarantee, that I would be here 8 months from now or 5 months from now or tomorrow. And what I would tell people is, none of us have any guarantees about being here tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
you can get hit by a bus or, God forbid, a nuclear bomb should fall or there are all kinds of different ways that we can die. But the fact is that we're all going to die. And just because I have been given a prognosis of 8 months doesn't mean that I will die before you.
Mm-hmm.
I can't tell you the number of people who looked at me pityingly about, having an 8 month prognosis. Who died long before I have, obviously
mm-hmm.
I'm not dead yet. So, but I mean, a lot of people who took care of me in the 80s
mm-hmm.
subsequently died themselves from AIDS and cancer and all kinds of other things. So that sense that none of us have any guarantees about tomorrow makes me really present to the present moment. Can you hear the helicopters that are flying over my
yes.
house? Oh, my God. I'm so sorry about that.
That's okay. It's not bad. It just sounds like something. I wasn't sure what it was. But, when you're talking about living in the moment and living in the present, I mean, that's one of the things as life coaches that we're constantly talking about with people is because if you're living in the past, you're not here in the moment, and you can't live in the future. The only way that you can create
yeah.
your future is by living in the moment. And, right? And the other
yeah.
thing is,
yeah.
It's such a good example. Unfortunately, what's going on in the world, and even especially our country, you don't know what's going to happen. We're losing people all over the place, all
right.
around us. We keep hearing
right.
about things, plus some of the horrible things that are going on in other countries. So there is no guarantee. You can be perfectly
right.
healthy and gone tomorrow. I mean, that sounds
right.
kind of,
right.
not a nice, happy thought. But that's the reality. So it is important to be here, be present in the moment with 100% energetic engagement as you have been living your life.
Yeah.
I just
yeah.
want to take a moment for our sponsor here on the Life Coach Radio
sure.
Network. We're proud to have as our sponsor Audible.com. Audible.com is the leading provider of premium digital spoken audio information and entertainment on the Internet, offering customers a new way to enhance and enrich their lives every day. Audible is the preeminent provider of spoken word audio products, which include more than 100,000 audio programs from more than 1,800 content providers. Receive a free audiobook with your 30-day trial when you sign up with Audible today at audibletrial.com/lifecoachradio. That's audibletrial.com/lifecoachradio. Now, here are some Audible books related to today's topic. And the Band Played On, Politics, People, and the AIDS Epidemic by Randy Schiltz. The Wisdom of Near-Death Experiences, How Understanding NDEs Can Help Us to Live More Fully by Penny Sartori. And Hold Tight Gently, Michael Callan, Essex Hemphill, and the Battlefield of AIDS by Martin Duberman. So don't forget to sign up for a one-month free trial to get your free audiobook today at audibletrial.com/lifecoachradio. audible.com, making listening a tool for life. And now back to our show. So we are now in part two of my interview with Steve Peters, AIDS activist, and we welcome your calls, comments, and participation in the show. We love it. You, the number here to reach us, if you would care to join us, is 646-716-9397. Again, 646-716-9397. So you've mentioned that you've had five near-death experiences, Steve. You know, I've never known anyone else who has experienced this. So would you mind describing the experience, what it's like?
Oh, sure. Well, you know, it's very, I mean, I've experienced the same thing that countless numbers of people have reported on in their near-death experience. I remember the first time that I experienced it was in 1985 while I was on that experimental drug, Suramin. And I was in the hospital. I was actually in the emergency room waiting to be hospitalized. And I was in the triage room, and they were trying to draw blood from me, and the blood just stopped flowing. And I remember them saying, "Pump your hand, Steve, pump your hand," you know, to try and get the blood flowing. And at that moment, I remember looking down on my body on the scene and wondering, why isn't he doing what they're telling him to do? And then I just didn't care anymore. I was in this tunnel, a dark tunnel with a bright light at the end, and I was surrounded by people who had loved me and had gone before me. I remember, my grandparents, you know, all kinds of different people, but one person in particular I remember was the mail carrier from when I was a little boy. He used to call me Steverino, and he was the only person who called me Steverino, and he was there. What a surprise to see him there. And I think, the most amazing, remarkable thing about all my near-death experiences was that sense of peace that just washed over me, that I finally understood all the things that, you know, I didn't understand about myself, and I understood, you know, why the world was the way it was, and there was just such a peace, the peace that passes all understanding. Mm-hmm. And I was just so comfortable, and I felt completely loved. I felt completely whole, and then I was back in my body, and I was pissed. and that basically is how I've experienced it each time I've crossed over come back, and I know that, you know, a lot of scientists will say, oh, it's, you know, those near-death experiences are just the result of the brain shutting down and chemicals misfiring in the brain as the brain shuts down. But, you know, I don't care. I don't care if that's what they think. I know what I have experienced, and I know that that kind of peace and love just transcends, you know, the body, that transcends life, and to me is evidence of the divine.
So you say, you know, I've already heard you talk about this wonderful sense of peace, and it sounds as though you're already aware of, or what I hear from that is that, you know, there's this understanding that the human condition, or being human, living in our bodies, not living as a soul, but living, you know, in our bodies, there is a certain anxiety of being human, that when you're released from that earthly body, all of that is gone, and it's like all of the pieces of a puzzle suddenly come together. And there's this great understanding. So I'm wondering what you feel you have learned, if anything, through these near-death experiences.
Oh, golly. Well, I you know, certainly I go back to being present in the present moment and just focusing on what's right there in front of you. And I, you know, when I do begin feeling anxious, you know, I try to remember that sense of peace and wholeness, and you know, it's like an acting exercise. You know, if I'm all anxious about this side or the other thing, I try to act as if I were at peace, and I use meditation and prayer, but particularly meditation, to let go of anxiety and stress and come back to that sense of peace that I have felt five times now. And, you know, the anxiety is just not worth it. And, you know, it doesn't solve the problem. What solves the problem is being at peace and allowing the answers to come through whatever you believe in, to that place of peace.
Mm-hmm. So kind of the divine, or it sounds as though you recognized, or you through these experiences, that there is a divine within, or that we are part of the great divine. I don't know if you know anything about the teachings of Kabbalah, but the teachings of I'm sorry?
Not really, no.
Well, it really it teaches us that we are all part of it. The Big Bang Theory, I won't spend much time on this, the Big Bang Theory is when we were this great vessel and we broke into a number of different pieces. We are all part of this great divine, and we all broke into different individual vessels, which are individual people, but we are all connected, you know, as in our energetic form. So I'm wondering if you think then there's any reason why you kept coming back. I know you're a man of faith, and you feel that faith is very important to even your being healthy and continuing on and being healthy not just physically but spiritually. And, you know, and that is all connected, that the body and, you know, the physical, if you are connected, you know, body, mind, spirit, as people say, there is a huge connection. And if you're dead spiritually, that's going to affect your physical being. So
absolutely.
I'm wondering if you think there is any particular reason why you kept coming back from those experiences, those near-death experiences.
Well, I think of two answers to that. One is that I'm not done yet. I have more to do, you know, and there's just a sense of destiny, you know, that I have more to fulfill. And the second answer to it is I love life. I really do. And I can't seem to get enough of it. I mean, my life just keeps getting better and better, Jan. It really does. And I'm just constantly surprised at the wonderful things that keep happening to me and the wonderful events I get to be a part of and you know, the experiences that I get to have and the love that I get to experience and, you know, the opportunity to be of service. I mean, all of that combines into a huge reason to not, you know, stay there, which in that place that is so beautiful. You know, so I love life and I don't want to miss anything.
That is so beautiful. You know, there's so much we can talk about. Unfortunately, we have a limited amount of time. So I want to jump ahead to some stuff that is just so, and I think our listeners are going to probably really want to know about too. So I know you've been interviewed by a lot of people, but please tell us about the Tammy Faye Baker interview. You know how that came to be.
Yeah.
And, you know, if anybody, it's YouTube, right, Steve? People can find it online. So if you want to, but wait till after the show. But, yeah, do go. It's fantastic. So, and your eyeglasses are so, what is the 80s?
Was that 80s. They were
so 80s.
Yes.
Yes,
the 80s.
I love it.
Glasses.
The whole thing is fabulous. So, you know, how did this come to be and the significance? Because there was a lot of, there was quite a bit of significance.
Right.
Both for before, you know, for this interview coming to be and then the aftermath. So I wanted to talk also about the resulting fallout for Tammy Baker from that interview.
Yeah.
So tell us all about it.
Well, I had done quite a lot of media already. I mean, there were there were no other people with AIDS in the early 80s who were talking on the level of media about the experience of having AIDS. And I had done a lot of media as a gay activist in the 70s and early 80s. So I just kind of fell naturally into talking about my experience. So anyway, Tammy Faye Baker decided that she wanted to interview a gay man with AIDS because no other televangelist had ever done that. And this was 1985, November of 85. Well, her producers scoured all of the southeastern and eastern United States and couldn't find anybody who was willing to go on the show with her. And they finally called the AIDS Project in Atlanta, whose executive director, Ken South, was a friend of mine, and he directed them to me. And they called and they said, you know, Tammy would like to do this show, and we negotiated back and forth, and I said, I want it to be live so you can't edit it and make it appear like I'm saying something that I'm not saying, you know, which I feared would happen with the televangelist who, you know, to this point had always had negative things about gay men and about lesbians and about AIDS in particular, mm-hmm. which was God's punishment for the abomination that is homosexuality, right?
Ugh. Right.
Anyway.
Oh, horrible
anyway.
Time.
Yeah. So I agreed to do it, and they wanted me to come to Charlotte. They sent me two first class air tickets to Charlotte so somebody could accompany me, because this was while I was doing Suriman, and it was 2 weeks after my first near-death experience. So I was kind of weak and I needed help. Well, anyway, as we were headed out the door to the airport, Tammy's producers called and said, don't come. We're going to try and figure out another way to do it. And they did. They decided to do the first ever satellite hookup that PTL, the network that Jim and Tammy Baker owned, the first satellite interview they ever did. So I sat in a studio out here, and I was, you know, I was on a TV sitting next to Tammy Faye Baker, who proceeded to interview me for 25 minutes. The interview was live, and she was so supportive. She asked a lot of what you and I might consider to be really stupid questions, but they were the right questions for her audience, you know, mm-hmm. asking questions like, well, maybe you're gay because you never really gave women a fair try.
Yeah,
oh, that's
dear.
It.
Well,
Tammy.
It was a different
no,
time, and I don't know if you know, the age range really varies of my listening audience, and I don't know if people remember Tammy Faye Baker, but Tammy and her husband Jim Baker had a network called, you referred to as PTL, it was Praise the Lord. So
right.
It was a very different time, and I think at this point, Jim was already, he had been arrested, right? Is this after?
No, that had not happened yet.
Oh, that had not happened yet. Okay, I'm sorry,
no,
I'm jumping
No, that didn't
gun.
Happen for another few years, but they built this huge empire with an amusement park, a Christian amusement park outside Charlotte, North Carolina. Anyway, Tammy ended up being very supportive of me and very positive about, you know, the possibility of being a gay Christian, which appalled Jerry Falwell and Jimmy Swaggart, who got hold of the interview and made a decision that, you know, this was the straw that broke the camel's back for them. And they started strategizing on how to bring Jim and Tammy down and destroy PTL, which they did 3 or 4 years later. And that's when Jim was arrested and for fraud and all of that sort of thing. And it was a turning point in Tammy Baker's life, too, I am told, by someone who was friends with her, because she decided that she had a positive affirming ministry to gay and lesbian people, and that and to people with AIDS. And she started going to MCC, the primarily gay and lesbian denomination, and she started going to hospices and being with gay men with AIDS as they died and all of that. I mean, it turned her life around. And so when Jim was arrested and PTL was destroyed, Tammy went on to have a very positive relationship with the gay community. And I'm told that my interview was the turning point for her in making all that happen. So
wow.
It was a remarkable event in my life. And I will probably always, I mean, when I eventually do die, I bet you the Tammy Faye Baker interview will be at the top of my obituary rather than anything else about me. That seems to be what most people know me for. But it is on YouTube. If you search Tammy Faye Baker and Steve Peters, spelled with an I.
P-I-E-T-E-R-S, yes.
Exactly. Then you'll come up with this interview. Yeah.
Well, you know what? I can even, after the show, I will put it onto the show information page. So if you go on there, you can also find it there. But it's true. If you go into YouTube and you just search for Steve Peters and Tammy Baker, and it will come up. That's easily found. I think you can even just put it into Google search. This interview was so instrumental in Tammy Baker's life and career that Charlene Tilton of the old TV show Dallas, that was very popular for many years, Charlene Tilton, what role did she play again on Dallas? Do you remember?
She was Lucy Ewing. Lucy. She was the young blonde vixen on the TV series.
I think she was right. She was the niece of J.R.
Right.
Ewing. Yes. If anybody remembers that, but that goes back quite a ways too. But anyway, she created a show about Tammy Baker,
right?
And your character is featured.
Right.
And your interview, this particular interview we're talking about, is actually part of the play. An actor is playing you in the show. And, why don't you tell us about that?
Well,
I
got a call from a friend saying, would you like to have dinner with Charlene Tilton? And I said, well, sure. And she said, Charlene Tilton is doing a show about Tammy Baker. And when we did have dinner, Charlene told me that, she and Tammy were friends in the last years of Tammy's life, and Tammy gave her the rights to her story. So Charlene created this play, it's basically a one-woman show, except that I am featured, or my interview is featured, throughout the show as the turning point in Tammy's life that it was. And at the end of the show, I come back and help her across as she's dying. And, of course, the implication being that I'm dead. So when the play was produced out here in L.A., they had me come and sit in the audience. And then they introduced me. Charlene introduced me after the interview, after the curtain calls. And so I would pop up out of the audience looking fully alive and healthy, and the audience was stunned every time.
He's back again.
He's back. Oh, my God. He's alive. He's alive. Yeah. So anyway, it was a remarkable experience for me, first of all, to see myself portrayed on stage by an actor who actually looked quite a lot like I looked back in the 80s. And it was the second time that I had been portrayed on stage. 20 or some years ago, a young playwright actor read my book, I'm Still Dancing, and decided to make a one-man show out of it. And I saw it a number of times, it's totally bizarre. Take my word for it. It's totally weird to see yourself portrayed on stage, to hear your words spoken by an actor in the context of a play. It's just a wonderful and weird experience.
Oh, well, you know what? I would love to see. I don't know if that play is if there's a recording of it somewhere, because I'm not out in L.A. and that the show was done in L.A. of course.
Right.
Right. Yeah. So I don't know.
Yeah,
if
they're talking about taking it to New York, so it may yet be out there in New York. Yeah, it's called Tammy Faye Tweets. At least that's the working title at this moment. And the whole premise is that Tammy Faye is in heaven looking back on her life. And, of course, now people tweet. So Tammy, mm-hmm. always wanting to be up on the latest stuff, she's tweeting from heaven.
I love it.
Yeah,
and Charlene
yeah.
Tilton played. I saw the photos of, you know,
right.
her transformation into Tammy Baker online, and it was
yeah.
really remarkable. You know, there's
I know.
Just two other things. We're running out of time, so I really want to
yeah.
cover a couple of other things quickly.
Sure.
You have mentioned the importance of faith. You already, you know, told us about how you felt about fairies, but you mentioned, or you've mentioned in the past about the importance of faith in just in living fully and living healthily and just in your survival and how well you've done and how, you know, how much alive you are, and also
yeah.
the importance of believing in fairies. So would you mind yeah. elaborating just a little bit on that for us?
Well, sure. We've talked about believing in fairies, but I mean, the broader issue is believing in something beyond yourself.
Mm.
I mean, when I was failing, my body was deteriorating, it was hard to believe in myself, but I could believe in God. So believing in something beyond yourself when you're dying, when your body is, you know, what some people consider betraying you, mm-hmm. it's really important to believe that there is a power that's greater than yourself. And, you know, it may be the tide coming in, or it may be the moon rising each night, or the sun rising each day. And it may be God, as you know, as you find God through your own spiritual journey. But it's really important that you not just center in yourself, but that you center in something beyond yourself, to believe in yourself. In my training as a psychotherapist, you know, it was really important for us to learn that, it was important for me to learn that one of the ways you can tell somebody is in real trouble psychologically is that they don't believe in anything beyond mm-hmm. themselves. And a good sign of mental health is believing in a power greater than yourself, which is something that the 12 steps teach us. Give us.
Mm-hmm.
That is so important. And, you know, for some people, it's believing in fairies or believing in leprechauns or, you know, pyramids or whatever.
Or angels, yeah.
Angels,
right.
Yeah, yeah.
Or, you know what, for some people, like us, it's believing in music. Music is almost like
yes.
a religion. Art and music, you know.
Yes.
These are the things that can help keep you grounded and sane.
Absolutely.
and finding
Absolutely.
The joy in
yeah.
in life.
Yeah.
And so I'd also like to know, what advice would the Steve Peters of today give the Steve Peters of the early 1970s or thereabouts?
Ooh, that is such a good question, Jan. What would I say to myself back then? I would say, be strong, be sure of yourself, be confident, be okay with yourself, that being gay is absolutely a wonderful thing, and that when you finally come out, you are going to thrive because you will finally have the freedom to be yourself. So don't be afraid. I was riddled with fear back then and anxiety about who I was, about how I would be in the world, about what I would do with my life. And as long as I lived in that fear, I was paralyzed, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so I would tell myself, get over it, queen, you know? and just be alive and be yourself, the people will love you all the more for being yourself. And indeed, I've found that to be true. And as I have become more myself, I have become more alive and more fully alive. And, you know, the gifts of being yourself and being proud of who you are, of owning who you are, it's beyond measurement, beyond measurement.
You know, you're talking about authenticity and acceptance.
Yeah.
And how those two things, because what people don't understand sometimes with what the depth of what authenticity is, and you have just described it so beautifully, and acceptance too. And you know, people sometimes think that authenticity and acceptance is kind of an acquiescence into some kind of weakness, an acceptance of something negative, and it's just the opposite. So you just described it so well. I can't thank you enough. And I also cannot believe how this hour has really flown by.
Oh, my God, it's just over, isn't it? Oh, my God,
how
did that happen?
Can you believe that? I really am hoping that we can do this again. There's so much more to talk about, Steve, so I'd love to invite you back.
I'd love to.
Oh, this is amazing. And, you know, because we're like at the end of our show, I can't believe we're almost at the top of the hour. So I want to thank my amazing guest and dear old friend. And when I say old, I don't mean he's old. I mean we've been friends for I won't even say how many years. Steve Peters, thank you for being on the show today. This has been such a special treat for me. It really has.
Well,
I'm Jan Jaffe. Oh, thank you. I'm Jan Jaffe, and it has been my privilege to have been your host today. I'd love to hear from you, and I'm offering our listeners a free 30-minute discovery and strategy session. And for more information, questions, whatever, please feel free to email me at info, that's I-N-F-O, at forwardtosuccess.com. You're invited to share any comments or feedback on our show website, lifecoachradionetworks.com. In addition to my solo interview show, I also host Think Tank, a roundtable discussion. And in fact, in our next show, we are going into in-depth about the topic of acceptance. So, and how it is the seed of so many other wonderful things and enables us to move forward in so many other ways. So I hope that you will all join us. That next episode of Think Tank about acceptance is on July 27th at 12 noon Eastern. I have two amazing co-hosts. They're brilliant, so I hope you'll join us. So, Steve, would you care to share any closing thoughts, comments, or contact information or whatever with our listening audience?
Oh, thanks, Jan. There's a saying in AA that acceptance is the answer to all my problems today. And you know, acceptance is such a vital part of just living life to the fullest, accepting what is in front of you, accepting who you are, and being proud of that. So, you know, be who you are, be here now, and be fully alive. The path to healing, you know.
That is beautiful. What a great message. Thank you so much, Steve. And I want to remind our listeners that all of our contact information and bio information is listed in today's show description, and please feel free to contact us for any further information or any questions. I'm just going to take a moment to announce a few of our upcoming shows on this The Life Coach Radio Network on July 20th at 12 noon, in depth, with Jan Jaffe. That's next week. I'm interviewing Shahinaz Al-Hanawi, a fascinating woman from Egypt. So please join us. That should be a great interview. And let's see, on the 25th, July 25th at 12 noon, Leap with Errol McClendon. And on July 27th at 12 noon, Think Tank. This is the show that I had just mentioned. All of these times are Eastern Daylight Times. So, and if it's Pacific, you know, those would be at 9 a.m. So I want to again thank my wonderful friend and guest, Steve Peters, and our caller, Michael, for joining me today and making this show a very, very special one. Thank you so much for listening, and have a wonderful, wonderful day.